Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. We have a lozenge in our mouth because I've been having quite a few coughing spells because of the pneumonia. So forgive me if my mouth sounds like I've got a little lozenge in it. That being said, obviously this is probably going to be the most entertaining. And I say entertaining because how well the press has sold and the mainstream media. Even Fox News is singing the song that the election's over. And the evidence proves that there are still many. Somebody did some analysis. I saw a friend of mine sent out an email that stated that Trump had 13 paths to winning this election. Biden has only 10. And so, be that as it may, this isn't over. It's got some time and it's percolating still. And I know there's lots of people looking and wanting to know what's going on. I will tell you that even though Biden becoming president is going to be terrible for America, there has been never a time or never a point when we should ever be concerned with who is in the White House. We need to be concerned with the government in compliance. If Congress is creating laws that are in compliance to the Constitution, then the president can't enforce unconstitutional laws. If the president doesn't use executive orders to legislate, and the same thing with the bench, if they stop using powers that they don't have to create laws, then we're within conformance of the Constitution. The problem is that we're so far out, people wish that President Trump would just declare martial law. Do you understand the magnitude of how wrong that would be? Just like stealing the election is equally wrong. The only high ground, period, is demanding full compliance to the Constitution. What's so difficult about this? This isn't rocket science. Either they're in compliance or they're not. There's all sorts of stories that give you reasons why people shouldn't be wearing masks with mask mandates and lockdowns and all these other things. And I go, there's a plethora of excuses out there to and to not. But there is only one concise law, and that is the Constitution, and state governments cannot make or create. State and below, any government within the states cannot create or enforce any law that abridges the immunities and privileges guaranteed by the Constitution. In other words, your right to assemble, your right to religious expression and worship as how you please and how per your conscience, with a mask or without a mask. The fact that I see people going to church and that the churches are scared. They're afraid of the evil tyranny that will be unleashed against them. I think that if you start realizing where we are, people, we are too close. I mean, the biblical prophecies are there. I mean, I don't even want to get into all of that. What I do want to get into is we need to continue looking at this stuff pragmatically. Pragmatically, as far as the election goes, we must demand that only legitimate votes count. There needs to be a full audit, and we need to take back this system because this system was completely baked. What we are witnessing and the information that's coming out is overwhelming that there is no legitimacy behind this election. It was driven by maniacal people and organizations to obtain a very specific outcome, which was Biden to win to move Harris into the presidency. So as you understand, what we have to do, and we had a meeting with the NLA, and there are, you know, I do get that there are some large-scale protests, but these large-scale protests, to me, are too mild. And I'm not talking about, you know, Molotov cocktails, that type of thing. We really, and I've said this before, and I actually said this in California back in 2013, 2014, that what we need to do is we need to start going after the mainstream media. We need to start protesting and shutting down the media and calling them out for the propaganda and basically the manufactured narrative that they are trying to jam down our throats. We need to take a stand. We need to actually prove to people that the mainstream media has been suppressing information and has been promoting false information. And so where are the organizations in doing this? Get involved with the NLA. They're a pretty wide-based organization. There's all sorts of organizations trying to start up, and there's organizations that already exist. The only organizations that, as far as I'm concerned, are really worth their weight are those who are actually engaged in solving the overall problem. Any organization that's myopic in form or myopic in mission is not an organization that's out really trying to solve the problem. They're just trying to capitalize on your passion about abortion or your passion about vaccines or your passion about this. It is not a myopic problem. This is a huge problem we're facing. And I know you get this. You need to start convincing people that this is a huge problem. We're at a magnitude that is so overwhelming, we can't, on an issue-by-issue, fight this. We have to take the one issue at hand, and that is compliance to the Constitution of the laws of the land. If we take that position, that we're going to actually make headway, we're going to win. We will win because we're not fighting the minutiae. We're not fighting this little, you know, myopic issue of abortion and education, vaccine, common code. It does all of these problems. We cannot fight one by one. We have to fight them in a grand scale by focusing on the compliance to the Constitution. So when you look at organizations, whether you want to get involved with it or not, my recommendation is to look at two things. What is their mission? Are they myopic on a passionate issue? Are they just vaccines, you know, health freedom or abortion or illegal immigration? Those are not designed to really solve the problem. They're just fighting one specific issue. And so that organization is either too short-visioned or they are designed to pull in people based on their passions to keep them engaged in a losing battle. Yep, that's right. And I believe the NRA is one of those organizations that has become a losing battle organization. It's not about the Second Amendment. It's about the entire Constitution. Organizations that have structure, and when I say structure, I'm talking about, you know, a lot of paid seats and or structure as far as the organizations and the almost like a government entity, then you're looking at an organization that is a self-licking ice cream cone. May not have the structure now, but when they start to create these teams and groups and levels, you're looking at a grand government type of organization. And in other words, their focus is the organization, not solving the problem. The only organizations that will solve the problem are not concerned about the organization per se. It is concerned about the problem and getting people engaged in what they need to do. And that was so refreshing hearing this conversation, hearing these types of words coming out of John Duresh's mouth on Monday. Having him say, we need to get everybody that we possibly can, who can articulate, who can understand the issues, who can, and I tell you folks, this is not rocket science. I can't say that enough. This is not that difficult. Anybody that understands fundamental contracts can understand the argument for republic review in our Constitution and this compact. And so there, it's so refreshing to hear this organization in, you know, and how they're really trying to help motivate people within the organization to start focusing on leading republic review in the states. So, to me, I honestly see that We the People Foundation with Bob Schultz and John Durash, the National Liberty Alliance, are really the two leading organizations. There's another one called the Constitution Association with Doug Gibbs. Here is another group that is not worried about structure. They're really worried about trying to fight the problem. And so when you look at organizations, look at their structure, look at what they're doing and, you know, how they're fighting the fight. And then two, look at what their mission is. Are they really myopic in mission? If they are, I'm just telling you, they're a waste of time. The people way up that are funding and trying to corral people into organizations like this have a purpose, and that purpose is to make you useless. Because if you're trying to fight this little finger over here that is doing so much damage, whether that be vaccines or any, you whatever you want to call the finger, whatever issue it is, it doesn't matter. The fighting of that finger will never take down and solve the problem. You have to start understanding this. And so when we come back, we want to start talking about the Constitution. But I had a conversation with Arlene Kolk of the Eagle Forum, and I want to express this information to you as soon as we get back after these two promos. Thank you so much. If you run a business or an organization, you already know email is an essential tool for communicating. If you're interested in reducing your overhead and increasing your productivity, I personally recommend you look into AdLocal email marketing services. AdLocal has a special offer for my listeners with email services that start at $10 a month for your first 1,000 addresses. If you want to increase customer retention, grow your market presence, track your statistics, and improve your engagement with your customers with modern, elegant emails that express the personality of your business with emails that integrate with your website, you need to contact AdLocal, and they handle the rest. Take it from me, AdLocal offers the best solutions for all organization sizes, and they lead with their pricing and the 24-hour customer service. Folks, it's time to call AdLocal at 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Okay, so the number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK or 215-867-8255. Do not forget my three C's when you dial in. And let's get on with the dialogue.
Okay, so as we were just going into break, I ran out of time, but I wanted to tell you that I had a conversation with Arlene Kolk, and she's the president of the Eagle Forum of California. It's a very large group in contrast to some of the other Eagle Forums, but I think Utah is another very large group as well. Anyway, and here's an organization that's trying to take a much broader aspect, but, you know, Arlene, she's bringing you the information on 5G. She's actually got a pamphlet that's coming out, and this is why I wanted to share with you. She has a pamphlet to warning people and informing them about this vaccine that's coming out, about information regarding nanobots, information regarding gene editing, information about, you know, the fact that this is not a vaccine to solve a problem. It is a vaccine to create compliance. And so I highly recommend, I can't wait. As soon as she releases this, it ought to be out tomorrow. And she promised to send it to me. And this way, and this may be like a little mini book, you know, 50 cent, you know, please, you know, if pay 50 cents to get it. And that's just to kind of help compensate all of her efforts and cost in getting all this stuff done. And anyway, I also sent her the information regarding the DOD back in 2005 when they were providing analysis on earlier work. This work began actually before 2005. In 2005, they were providing the analysis of the work of doing gene editing and how they were able to take religious zealots and highly religious people and actually water them down and make them passive regarding their religion. Because you have to understand that the liberals recognize that if you believe in God, you believe in Christ, then you are a problem. You're a real problem. And they don't want to have to necessarily look guilty of killing a bunch of Christians. If they can use manipulation in gene editing and those types of things by duping people, then they can get rid of most everybody to a point where everybody becomes so passive and starts actually looking at people who refuse the vaccines as not only outliers, but dangerous demagogues. This is basically very similar to what they did in Germany. They identify the enemy and then boom, they actually go after. And at that point in time, people say, you know what? I'm okay with them killing these zealots. These guys are bad because they present the information and manipulate the data and misinformation to make you believe that these people are bad. When most, if not all, of these people would never harm a hair on anybody's head. You've never found. And when you look at these guys that are supposedly really extreme conservatives, far right, they're not what we would consider the true liberty-supporting people. When you have people willing to use force, remember the scale of liberty. This is why we go through this, so you understand that somebody, you know, on the scale of white in the scale of liberty is somebody that believes everybody must make their own choices. So you cannot be forced. You cannot be compelled. So people that want to compel you are moving towards the progressive side, the dark side, the evil side of compulsion and slavery. It doesn't matter for what purpose. Their cause is for enslaving people. They're equally bad. So, and this is why when people, you know, I remember I really upset a liberal when they made a comment about, you know, because they were trying to catch me on this, what happened in South Carolina when supposedly this Ku Klux Klan or Nazi, you know, ran over the Antifa, Black Lives Matter folks and so forth. And she said, what's your feelings and comments about that? And I said, I remember sharing this with you a few years back. And I said, I think it's kind of funny. And she looked at me like aghast at how I could even say that. And I go, two extreme left organizations going after each other. I mean, you know, wouldn't it be ironic if they all killed each other off? Then we would all be okay. And that's when she just used the F-bomb. And this is a large public gathering. And, you know, you use the F-bomb at a very loud level. People go, huh? And, you know, and then she says, I just hate you. I despise you. I wish you were dead. And she just proved my point. She proved my point that these people are wired to be completely intolerant and they are refusing to accept anything but their paradigm. And if you don't agree with their paradigm, then you will be whatever's necessary. You'll be killed, put away. You are the problem. And that's how we're being dealt with. This is why the scale of liberty is a fundamental premise that you must understand. Anybody that believes that you have to be compelled, that there has to be some law, there has to be some level of force, and we all find ourselves sliding a little bit towards that, that if you're truly an embracer of individual liberty, individual sovereignty, you'll recognize that and you'll snap back. But sometimes people get caught up in this myopic, you know, paradigm of, oh, we've got to stop this behavior. We've got to stop this. No, what we need to do is we need to educate people that we have a system in place. We have a thing called the Constitution that actually protects us, that protects, you know, our liberties and our freedoms and our ability to choose for ourselves, which is fundamentally our sovereignty. Anyway, so Orleans got this information that's coming out regarding the vaccines. I want you to get a hold of this, and I'm hoping that she has great pricing, or at least offers it to various, you know, for free to people. To me, the information is more important than the price, if that makes sense. And that we need to actually be very, very clear that we are sending, I'll just say, a very clear and concise message that this is all about compliance. This must be about full compliance of the Constitution. So anyway, let me kind of jump forward as we go back to what we were just talking about. And what we were talking about were the 9th and 10th Amendments. And what we're doing is we're kind of progressing the timeline of what built up to the Revolution, what built up to the need for the Constitutional Convention, and what was in the Constitution. And we just kind of wrapped up the Bill of Rights and some of the key factors, as well as some of the protections, like the ex post facto laws and so forth. And so the next step after we kind of look at, you know, the launching of the Bill of Rights, there were a few little integral things. And one of the things I will mention to you is the, I think it's the 1792. It was about the finance, and it was an act. It was the Assumption Act. Thank you. See, I've got this gray matter, and it's in there. So in 1792, Hamilton became this huge argument for this assumption tax or this Assumption Act that was basically going to tax people to pay the debt off of those states who were unable to come up with the necessary funds to pay their debt. Now, to look at this, one of the few states that actually paid its debt because it was an economic engine was Virginia. Virginia was a colony, a country that was based on economic freedom in some respects. And its drive was, you know, economics. Its differentiator was its economics. And so that's why there was a more abundance of wealth and even more people participating in Virginia, because people cared more about their independence economically than a few other things. Like, you know, it wasn't just about religion for them. Not that it wasn't about religion, it just wasn't only about religion, like up in the Puritans area. Now, up in the Puritans area, Massachusetts, New England states, they were far more focused on the religious things and the religious aspects. So it's not that there wasn't money, it's not that there wasn't commerce. They were unable to pay their debts, though. And so Hamilton came out with this act that was basically going to assume the payment. And right out the gate, the whole argument regarding, you know, whether this was constitutional or not constitutional, whether they could have this power or assume this power of create, because just to be clear, there were two sides to this argument of the Assumption Act. On the pro side, one was that they were going to create a bank, and two, they were going to collectively pay off the debt. Okay, so putting aside the argument of whether the federal government can have a bank or not, The one thing the federal government cannot do is they cannot pay off debt for one state and not for another. Or they can't pay off any debts, period, because they have to deal with each of the states regarding taxes, impost, tax relief, what have you, uniformly. So when you see that they've, you know, we're going to pay off the debt for Massachusetts and a few of these other states that couldn't pay their war debt, that was violating the uniform clause in Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 1, that they have to do these things in a uniform manner. They can't play favorites. And that's exactly what Hamilton was doing. And what Hamilton was doing, because you have to understand, the people of the Northeast were the anti-federal, not the anti-federalists, they were the Federalists and the Anglophiles who really loved the crown and the concept of having, you know, a permanent king and more central powers. Anyway, we'll be right back, and I'll be back on the same topic when we get back after these two promos. So please stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.
To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath even though we're not required to take it because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.
That number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's. And if you're ready to call in, the lines are open.
And so as I was saying, I kind of ran out of time. New England was, they had this propensity towards large government. If you look at Massachusetts and New England, they were one of the first to get involved with state-run healthcare, you know, grandioso government and so forth. And one of the things that you also probably don't know is that when they did create this bank, John Adams heavily invested in this, and he actually went bankrupt because of that. He lived with his son, John Quincy Adams, for a while until he could get back on his feet financially. And he ended up selling his library of books, as well as Thomas Jefferson selling his library books after the War of 1812 to repopulate the Library of Congress with their books because they were both destitute. Actually, Jefferson lost everything. When he died, everything was taken. There was nothing left for his heirs practically. And so it would have been sad to see, and there was probably some workings in keeping Jefferson from having to go to debtor's prison. just because they didn't want to see, you know, the author of the Declaration of Independence, as well as, you know, former president and so forth. So he probably got extra consideration. But nevertheless, this Assumption Act created this concept of a bank giving government power that wasn't in the Constitution, and this concept of paying for some of the states that were unable to pay their war debt. And so when you look at how this was playing out, the Assumption Act was going to fail. And as a matter of fact, Thomas Jefferson was critical, believe it or not, in allowing or helping the Assumption Act to pass, because the deal on the table, and this all happened, so here's the backstory. This all happened, I believe it was Madison's house, and or the home he was renting while he was in Congress in 1792, and Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson came and visited for dinner, and they had this basically dinner meeting where they put everything on the table. And Madison was ardent about not changing his position. He was not going to say that something was constitutional after he had clearly argued on the Congress floor that it was unconstitutional. And making him recant and saying he was wrong would have been an egregious violation of one's honor and integrity, if you understand what I'm saying. And so what they all agreed on was that Madison wouldn't have to recant, but he would no longer lead the opposition. He would basically leave it to say, I've said what I said, and I think everybody needs to do the due diligence and choose for themselves. And I don't believe he voted for it, but I believe that the Assumption Act barely passed. And so here's the interesting thing. In the recess of Madison's mind, he knew that this was all unconstitutional. That all it would take is the states. And I say this, that this was planted in the back of his mind, because as things played out coming up in 1798 with the Alien Sedition Acts, he started realizing, hey, you know, the states can step in at any point in time and undo the stupid bank and everything else. When he became president, and here is the irony, because this is one of the points in time where somebody that stood up and said, you know, this is unconstitutional, when he was fighting the War of 1812, and with all things considered, I believe he had an opportunity under his presidency not to renew the charter for the National Bank, and he allowed it to be renewed. And I think that was because he needed the funding and the financing to fight the War of 1812. And we all know that Andrew Jackson did the right thing, but he did so many wrong things. He may have got, you know, Andrew Jackson may have done some pretty good things, but some of the things he did that were so wrong, those good things he did cannot even answer for some of the wrongs that he did. The Trail of Tears, to me, was one of the most egregious sins a president, any public servant, could have created and had under their hand, under the laws of the Constitution, commit that kind of mass murder and that kind of treachery against individual liberty and individual sovereignty, and undo all the work that Washington, Jefferson, and many of the presidents before Andrew Jackson came along. I'm just trying to give you this picture of how things were moving forward. Do not think that at any point in time, the Republic was resting on its laurels. There were the trappings of Spain to the south, France to the west and to the north, and England to the west, north, and east. And so the pressures that were being placed upon this newly formed republic, the small United States, was hard to fathom, just due to the fact that any ship that got caught by the British Navy, and they deemed that that ship was considered, you know, British property, those the subjects on it operating or what have you, they were impressed, and Britain was fundamentally, they were violating the agreement of, I think it was the Versailles Treaty, and there were some other treaties. I'm trying to remember. There were like two or three different treaties, and Britain kept on coming back to the table saying, you have to help us. You have to actually pay for, you know, the lost property from the Tory Acts. When you banished all these British loyal subjects and sent them back to us, well, they came without property. We need that property to help pay for some of the debts and so forth, and that's theirs. And we basically refused to I'll just say to liquidate or even pay a penny for the debt we confiscated. I should say for the properties we confiscated to cover some of our debts. So anyway, moving forward, then we kind of, you know, run into this new paradigm of a national tax system to help pay for the Assumption Act. And so, voila, Hamilton came up, and one of the ideas that he had, by the way, to help pay for and bring revenue into the national government was a horse tax. That's right, he wanted to tax the sale of horses. Now, there was never an argument that he couldn't do that. I just want to be clear here. So people that think that the federal government can't, you know, create duties, excises, and taxes like that, they absolutely can. But here was the reason why that the horse tax failed, is because the states were disparately dependent on horses. In the Northeast, hardly anybody had horses. It wasn't a requirement. But down in the agrarian society, where you had a plantation, a farm, or what have you, I mean, horses were important. I mean, horses did a lot of the work. I mean, they were our old-fashioned tractors. They horsepower, right? That's where that term came from. And so when it got argued in Congress regarding the uniformity clause, it was put aside rather quickly, because it was recognized that it would be more onerous on the agrarian states than the, I'll just call them the factories, it was the beginning of the Rust Belt, where they started creating factories and processes and so forth, that manufacturing. Thank you very much. Thank you, caller, for helping me out there. I'm just kidding. The point is that the Northeast was leaning more into manufacturing, which is where Hamilton was trying to favor. So Hamilton was already cherry-picking what parts of the Republic he wanted to actually wage economic warfare and, you know, try to take advantages of others. And so when you look at how Madison and Jefferson really had started creating this championship. They became the champions of not slavery, but the agrarian society, the people that, you know, weren't in manufacturing. And there was a huge paradigm, you know, I won't say shift, but there was a huge gap, void, abyss between the concept of manufacturing and industry and the agrarian society. I mean, almost an ideological gap, because Madison and Jefferson saw the agrarian society as a wholesome society and saw the manufacturing as one that would lead to the exploiting of people. I mean, they literally had these ideologies that were, you know, dividing themselves between the Northeast and the Southern, or the majority of the United States. But if you want to understand why the Rust Belt formed the way it formed, because it was in the Northeast, and the Northeast said, this is the ideology we wanted to follow. This is what they didn't understand. And this is why the Northeast was destitute after a matter of 50 years or so, because as soon as they could duplicate those same processes where labor was cheaper, they would instantly move that factory, the manufacturing, to the south or to a southern state to where they could do it cheaper. And then they would move it further south so they could do it cheaper. And they were constantly rebuilding and creating this rust belt behind them. That's how this all started. Anyway, when we come back, we'll get into more of the layout of moving forward on this Constitution. We'll be right back after these two promos.
Have you taken the time to watch our presentation on YouTube that provided an irrefutable argument of what we have to do to save our Constitution and our Republic? I know it's over an hour and 30 minutes, but you only need to watch the first 30 minutes. If you take the time to watch this presentation, I promise it will change your paradigm regarding what our Constitution is and what we have to do if we are going to save it, our liberties, our sovereignty, and our republic. We already have answers to most of the questions that you might think of after watching this presentation, and we want to help you get to a point where you have a profound understanding of the audit and republic review process. This is why our bullet overview and flowchart of both the argument and process is available on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. The sooner you get informed, the sooner you can get involved and make an impact. So go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org to the Take Action page. That's where you'll find the video. Thank you so much.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process.
Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255.
Okay, so we're cruising along here as a republic, and we still had this debt thing, because we never really addressed how they overcame this unconstitutional application of taxing everybody, but helping out only a few of the states. In other words, this first violation of, called the Assumption Act. And so, and I want you to understand that this was a one-time violation. It may have created a hole in the parchment, but it wasn't an egregious violation of expanding, you know, bureaucratic powers per se. Because they could have easily, and as a matter of fact, Andrew Jackson, like I said, was the one that actually dispelled and got rid of the National Bank. Boom, done. And the ideologies or the paradigms between presidents and their economic ideals, this became, I think, insightful to see how presidents were starting to use their ideas and populism to, you know, invoke things that were unconstitutional, because it would run a campaign of being able to, you know, solidify silver like Ulysses S. Grant or all these other little things of agriculture, the rail system, the expanding the West. All of these things were platforms. These were things that they were talking about that were violations of the Constitution. Friends, I want you to understand, when a politician stands up and says, I want to use the public purse to give you health care, they are violating the law because they are making a political promise that violates, first off, violates the Constitution, and secondly, is purchasing a vote. Both of those things are illegal. You can't buy votes. You can't say, I'm going to give you something if you vote for me. And so all of these things were protected. This is why if you look at Teitler's cycle of democracy and how democracies fail, the framers put everything necessary in this Constitution as long as we adhered to it. As long as Madison stated and Hamilton stated, as long as the states took a proactive role, created barriers, were vigilant in guarding against the aggrandizing of the federal government, then they would be safe. They wouldn't, you know, fall under the cycle of democracy. Well, so anyway, back to this assumption and the creation of the bank, they had to create some form of taxation. And that taxation was the distilled liquor tax or the whiskey tax. And as you know, when they passed the liquor tax, if you've read my article, What is the Real Problem in Martial Law in the 21st Century, you'll start to understand that the protests, those who stood up against the federal government and taxing liquor, and how I think the UN is coming. They don't like what I'm saying here. Getting into this whiskey tax became this shift because people didn't realize what excise taxes were and what imposts and so forth. And so they didn't realize that the federal government had this ability for direct taxing. Now, James Monroe, who was an anti-federalist, actually used those words. You have direct tax capability. And the whole point of the defunct Confederacy was the fact that it could not direct tax. It had to plead and beg. And this was the major change in the Constitution, that the federal government could tax. But here's the thing. They can only tax for spending money on things that are constitutional. Now, their debt, the fact that they assumed this debt, right, wrong, or indifferent, the federal government does have the power to create debt. But they can only spend that money to create that debt on things that are within their scope or powers, enumerated powers. In other words, they can't spend money on the railroad system, which is what they did. They can't spend money on agriculture, which is what they did, or paying bounties or anything that the social engineering that started coming with Andrew Jackson and beyond, as they started expanding spending, well, then they had to start taking on debt. It got to a point by the progressive era that they were spending so much more money that they basically said, we have to institute a direct tax on income of the people. And then this way, they would be able to, you know, obtain more revenue instead and spend the money recklessly as they had been doing. And so when you start looking at the taxation, revenue, spending, and so forth of the United States over the course of of its history, you can see how it started ramping up. And some of the things that really started in the 1800s, again, was like the railroad and the expansion of the West, and some of the things that they shouldn't have been doing. You have to, when you start looking at them aggrandizing, it was for noble purposes, as they were telling us. I'm here to tell you otherwise, that there's no nobility in violating the Constitution. As George Washington said, that's how, you know, countries are destroyed. So they created this distilled liquor tax. There was this huge rebellion, and they went into Pennsylvania and enforced, one, the whiskey tax, and two, they arrested 24 men and charged them with treason, and two were convicted of treason for protesting federal law. Treason. Now, look at what these yahoos did in Seattle and or Portland and Philadelphia and all around this country, where the liberals and the Bolshevik Revolution has been running amok in our streets, damaging property and so forth. This is an insurgency. This is a revolution. It is violations of the Constitution. And fundamentally, it is all treason. I mean, the guys that wrote the Constitution considered the whiskey tax rebellion treason. Okay, so when you look at the Constitution and the federal government's responsibility, they are to call forth the militia in enforcing the laws of the Union, as well as suppressing insurrections and rebellions, as well as invasions. So anyway, so as they moved forward, they finally proved that they could tax, that they could arrest, they could enforce, that the Constitution gave them all the power necessary to function. They didn't need to create an IRS. They didn't need to create an ATF. They didn't need to create the Department of Interior and so forth. And we're actually going to prove all of this stuff as we kind of lay out as the Constitution and as this republic grows. So what we end up going into now is the Virginia and the Kentucky resolutions. And so we don't have time to go into all of these. But what we're going to do is we're going to set the stage, because in 1798, now it's halfway through Adams's tenure as president, Adams basically starts to realize that he's losing a popularity contest. And with Jefferson and Hamilton, as well as Madison and Hamilton, going at odds, Hamilton was the Oz behind the curtain in the John Adams administration. Most of the judges that Adams placed, even though there was, at the very end, when Adams said, "I'm not going to have much to do with you anymore," he was still really more akin to Hamilton, and he aligned with Hamilton's suggestions on judiciaries. And Hamilton had already cherry-picked those judiciaries, or I should say the judges, that would be promoting big government and aggrandizing the federal government under the mystical clauses, which is what we call them. You know, the Necessary and Proper Clause, the Commerce Clause, the General Defense and Welfare Clause, as well as the Supremacy Clause. These clauses were used by the court to help justify the growth of the federal government. And this was all a part of Hamilton's plan. And John Marshall, who was a very close friend of Hamilton, was one of the lead instigators. And as a matter of fact, I forget the name of the book. I believe it's Russell Kirk is the guy that wrote the book, but it's like From Burke to Something. It's about modern day progressivism, modern day, you know, philosophy in the United States and so forth. And in this book, even he points out, and I actually cite this, that Marshall looked up to Hamilton. Hamilton was truly his mentor, and that he believed that, you know, everything that Hamilton told him was gospel truth. Even though, and so this is the most important thing, regardless of what Marshall said in his rulings, when his comments and opinions in his rulings on cases conflicted with what he said in the ratification debate, which is the legally binding definitions and terms of the Constitution, then he was deliberately committing rebellion against the Constitution and actually was perjuring himself from the testimony that he provided to the state of Virginia exactly what this Constitution meant. So this is why we have to start viewing some of these people as nefarious and with machinations, or maniacal with machinations of undermining the strict limitations that are within the Constitution. So, in our next episode, we are going to open up the 1798 resolutions and show you how Thomas Jefferson and James Madison took Jefferson's idea and created Republic Review. With that, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, as you know, online fraud is on the rise, and it's more important than ever for your new and existing customers to be able to determine whether they are using a website with a secured connection. If you didn't know, Google mandated in 2017 that all data submitted to its linked websites must be secure with SSL certificates. Without SSL certificates, your site is listed by Google as not secure.
In other words, without these certificates, your site will be harder to find, and this will impact new traffic and ultimately your revenue. Whether you're a blogger or in e-commerce, AdLocal will help protect your website from all forms of data breaches, phishing scams, and build a secure environment for your businesses, big or small. Contact AdLocal by calling 866-88-ADLOCAL or visit them on the web at www.adlocal.com for custom pricing.